Guaso, bro.
Ay.
There's not a rule that you have to use the three subs.
He's the best left back in Canada, without a doubt.
And hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Third Sub Podcast. I'm your co-host Alexander Gungaruzic, joined as always by Samuel Rowan. And yeah, it's, I hope everyone's enjoying the off season. Certainly we have. It's been funny. I just texted Sam this week, be like, podcast this week, and then we sat down and we're like, man, nothing's happened. And I guess that's kind of the beauty of the off season, right? Those periods where nothing kind of happens. But hey, maybe we had some sort of immaculate foresight, because literally as we were planning the show notes, the biggest piece of news that we're all waiting for dropped, and one that will set the tone for the rest of the Whitecaps offseason. And no, it's not a Richie Lherae extension, although that would probably be news item number two. That would be just as big. But of course, that is the suspension of Vanni Sartini for 6 games, fresh off the press. So we'll of course dive into that before looking at some revisiting our preseason takes from the Vancouver Whitecaps. We dusted those off and found it, so we can have some fun and laugh and also pat ourselves on the back about that. Talk about some postseason awards, because no better time to do that now that the dust has settled a bit on the season, that there's been this quiet period, there hasn't been all too much movement. And of course, we'll end off with some fun way too early predictions as we head into this off season. So it's gonna be a more Whitecaps heavy episode here on episode 187, and should it be a good one. But before we dive into the big item of news, Sam, how's it going this week?
Yeah, not doing too bad. Hope everyone is well and enjoying the off season. Sitting here in Canada for the first time in a while, so that's nice. Good to be back, and certainly a little bit excited about that. And obviously, as you mentioned, Alex, the Vanni Sartini news, we didn't know it was going to be dropping when we planned this show, but fortunate that that's now official. Took so long to come together, which was, I would say, a surprise, but at the same time, not really knowing the way Major League Soccer operates. Yeah, it's going to be interesting looking back at our preseason takes, some of them very, very accurate, some of them not quite on the mark. So I think that's going to be interesting when you have 2020 hindsight. And then, yeah, we'll kind of review the season from a handing out awards perspective. And also at the end of the show, great suggestion by Alex, we're going to do a couple bold, way too early 2024 predictions. And we'll see, obviously, in a couple months, how those are looking. So should be a good one. Looking forward to diving into it. And thanks everyone for joining us for some off-season chat.
Yeah, and I'm excited, especially for the predictions at the end, and even just revisiting, because look, I think one thing that you've come to know with this show is that we love to throw out predictions, but sometimes we don't always revisit our predictions. And you know, I think it's always fun to pull back the hood and be like, all right, how, like, you know, what went wrong? Also, like, it's a good assessment of like, okay, you know, I'm looking back at my predictions, and spoiler alert, maybe I was a bit more optimistic about a Sergio Cordova than I should have. You live and you learn, but then you also see everything else. It's basically just a good chance to see where to learn from our mistakes, so that heading into next year, we can hopefully be experts and nail on our predictions. So we'll look to work on that. Anyways, one thing we could all predict for sure was that Vanni Sartini was going to get a hefty suspension. And, you know, it just felt like he was going to be made an example of. And I think it's fair, as we said at the time, or at least what I said at the time, it's something where he did cross a line. And just in terms of, you know, the state of the sport right now with refereeing and, you know, abuse of officials, Vanni was always going to be made an example of. So the hammer was always going to drop. This is no surprise. Ultimately, though, it is quite always surprising to see the final verdict. So for those unfamiliar, Vanni Sartini, post-game comments implying, you know, joking, of course, as we know, but of course implying that, you know, if referee Tim Ford was found in False Creek, that Vanni would be the number one suspect. And then also, don't forget, it's not just the comments in the conference. He called him a disaster. during the game. He got a red card, which is an automatic one-game suspension, so he was guaranteed to be suspended. He also kicked an ad board, came on the field after he'd been ejected. Like, even beyond the Tim Ford comments, this could have easily been a 2 or 3 gamer on its own. But it's official at 6, so it's 1 for the red card plus 5 additional for everything else that occurred. There'll also be a fine, and Vanni Sartini will also have to take some courses to, you know, anger management, etc. courses. And interestingly enough, if he does well in these courses, he can actually, there's a chance he could petition to get the suspension lowered, but as of now, that's all that he got. Also worth noting that they also announced everything else that occurred with it, so I'll just quickly roll through it before we dive into Vanny's, you know, Vanny's suspension in particular. But LAFC's Jesus Murillo got fined for his dive when Richie Larea made slight contact with him in the first, I think it was first half of that game. So that was one from LAFC, and then from Vancouver. This one's going to take a minute, so get ready. But Vanny got fined for the mass confrontation policy. Yohei Takaoka, Ranko Veselinovic, Ryan Gauld, and Simon Betcher were all issued fines for inciting slash escalating a mass confrontation. The Whitecaps technical staff and players were violated for the league's policy regarding entering the field of play. Of course, a lot of them ran out of the field after Buonga scored the offside goal. That was eventually disallowed. And then Yusuf Daha and Michael D'Agostino, as well as Luis Martins, Ali Ahmed, and Javane Brown were all fined for entering the field in a confrontational matter during a confrontational incident. And lastly, Matias Laborda ends up being the only one to get a one-match suspension, and he got an undisclosed fine for entering the field of play in a confrontational manner. All this to say, I think the big winner here is Sam Adekugbe, who somehow avoided both fines and suspension when I thought he could have been one of the guys who could have been hit the hardest. So I think he's the big winner here from this whole investigation. But no, jokes aside, Sam, what were your kind of thoughts on all that?
Okay, yeah, we'll try to keep this somewhat organized. I guess I'll deal with the last bit first. As you mentioned, Sam, probably lucky to avoid something. I also thought it was just kind of a W for the Whitecaps in general that Matias Laborda was the only one suspended at the start of next season, because Takaoka, Adekugbe, you know, some of the guys that came off the bench, there were lots of candidates for one match suspensions, and we've seen MLS do this in the past where sometimes they do hand them out like candy. So I think that was a bit of a win for the Whitecaps. Now, going back to Vanni Sartini, I think you outlined it well, where regardless of the JJ Adams tweet, the, you know, the whole shebang that went along with that, this is 3 or 4 match suspension territory for Vanny before he actually heads back to the locker room, right? Like, that's just when you're automatic one match ban for the red card, you know, kicking the ad board, not coming off the field, making some gestures.
A middle finger too, yeah, right?
Yeah, right, like that's 3-4 matches right there. So, you know, ultimately the post-match press conference type stuff gets him another match or two. I think when you add it all up and you say 6 games, that seems like a lot. But at the same time, I understand when you sort of individuate every incident, you think that, would a match be a fair suspension for each of these things? And you actually look at it and you're probably like, yeah, that makes sense. So overall, I think it's a bit harsh, especially given some of the other suspensions that have been handed out recently for other MLS disciplinary issues. However, I think when you break it down and segment it, it's not crazy. So I'm not a huge fan of the MLS being so sensitive to public criticism. I think it's a bit ridiculous, but at the same time, Vanny knew what he was getting into to a certain extent. So I think for the most part, this is fair if maybe a match or two on the heavy side. But that's the game you play with when you open yourself up to this stuff. From a footballing perspective, I think it's going to be really just interesting, a great early season storyline, what impact Vanny's absence will have. There's going to be more of a focus on assistant coaches, the staff that Vanny has developed over the last 2 seasons here, a Michael D'Agostino, you know, will Ricardo Clark step up and play a bit of a role? if asked to, just very interested to see how that's going to go at the start of next season. Will the team struggle at all, or will Vanny have his guys coached up in the right way and well prepared? I would think it would be more the second category, but it'll be something to track. And so, yeah, I think big picture, players probably a little bit lucky not to catch a few more suspensions. The Vanny thing feels slightly harsh, albeit pretty understandable. And then just looking ahead, I think, you know, be interesting to check out how the support staff, which Vanny talks about a lot, how important it is to build that ecosystem, have everyone in really solid communication with one another. He's a guy who's coaches, as we've talked about a lot in this show. So I hope for Vancouver that will show through at the start of next season.
And yeah, that's it. It'll be interesting to see, of course, how what Vanny takes from this, because obviously it is very unprecedented. For what it's worth, Vanny did earn some suspensions this year already, or at least a suspension for yellow card accumulation. So it's something that maybe even before this outburst, it'll be something that, you know, I'm sure now, especially knowing the heightened intention that'll be on him, we might see a tamer Vanny next year, at least when it comes to officials. Of course, I don't think Vanny's ever going to lose his personality that sees him cartwheel when they win big games, etc., taking shirts off. But he was suspended at one point. Michael D'Agostini was behind the bench when they beat LA Galaxy 4-2 in MLS play. So, hey, if he can keep up that perfect record, maybe he might be gunning for a job at some point. But no, we'll see what happens in that regard. But yeah, that's basically the big thing as well, to see what Vanny learns from this. Ultimately, again, I'm not really too surprised about the suspension. And I kind of, my thoughts are that even again, from Vanny's perspective, you can understand that anger and fervor that was there towards the officials, because it was one where Vancouver, you know, they had a genuine gripe, but also, like, again, there has to be a precedent, there has to be, you know, it's a control of behavior, if that makes sense. Really, I think the biggest thing though that can be taken away from this is, I guess two things, that it feels like MLS is at an interesting place with its officials, especially in light of the Matt Miazga situation, where he entered the referee's locker room, got a 3-game ban. And now the MLSPA has come out and slammed the referees union for how they handled that situation, because both in the Vanny and the Miazga situation, the referees organized union was out right away being like, we condemn, and putting out strong comments. MLSPA didn't comment. They let the investigation play out. And now they're calling out the referees union for, you know, trying to interfere and mess with the process. And yeah, I think all of that to say, I think it's going to lead to a very interesting discussion between those unions, because I think one thing as well that you see in all of this, Vanny, again, like we mentioned since day one, should be suspended. That's not any doubt of my mind that shouldn't happen. Because, you know, you see some like, oh, he shouldn't get suspended. No, he should get suspended. I think there's precedent for him there to be made an example of for good reason, because I think that sort of behavior can't be encouraged at a wide scale, not across the professional game, because look, that stuff will never go away in the professional game. There's so much at stake that, you know, people are always going to be hot-headed. But I think more of the amateur game, and people watching, you know, professional coaches behave like that, it might trickle down in the amateur game, and no one wants that. And I think Vanny himself would probably not want that as well, right? You don't want young 15-year-old refs dealing with that sort of abuse just because it's done at the professional level. But I think as well, on the flip side of it, there's the question of, you look at what's going on across Europe and across, you know, MLS, where there's a lot of controversial decisions. And you look, for example, recently, the VAR crisis in England, some of the decisions, or even this week in Champions League, where there's a confusion with the rules and PSG got that ludicrous penalty that's literally in the new rules. If it hits the body first and hits the hand, it's not. And UEFA comes out, oh, there was an error of the application of handball law. Yet what happens? Nothing really happens. And I think that's the bigger issue to say all this, to go back. Vanny had an outburst, deserved suspension. Tim Ford also, you know, didn't have a sparkling refereeing performance. And what happens? He gets demoted for a game, but there's not anything in the sense of, okay, he's answering what happened. Cause I'm not saying like put him to the grills and be like, okay, like you know, grill him, but it would just be nice, at least from coaches and players, that every time they make a mistake, you stand up and you hear from them and they explain what they did wrong and whatnot. Just for the sake of everyone, you know, at a certain point, fans are going to want to, and coaches and everyone's going to want to hear from referees, at least explain their decision. It's the same way a coach will explain why they chose a 3-5-2 instead of a 4-3-3. You might not agree with it, but they're saying it. And the fact that when a referee makes a big decision that ultimately we never really know what happens, that sort of transparency can't be good for the sport. And at least that's been a nice thing to see out of England, that this VAR crisis, for better or for worse, they're now releasing VAR audio tapes. And I think it's been fascinating to see. I've learned a lot watching some of these tapes. Like, I watched the full 5 minutes of the Newcastle Arsenal tape a few weeks ago. Like, it was fascinating to learn like how the process went, at least hearing what goes right, what goes wrong. Yet you look at MLS with some of these decisions, nothing's kind of happening, in the sense of you hear all this stuff about the Miazga incident. You see what happened with Tim Ford in this game, and nothing kind of happens from that perspective. And I think that's the one where the Whitecaps can have a legitimate gripe and fans and be like, all right, why isn't there more accountability on that part? And I think between what MLSPA dropped today, I wonder if we could be trending towards seeing something like that, because that's the bigger issue that seems to be at play.
Well, what's interesting about everything you just said is that, to me, this is something that spans far beyond MLS and even sport, really. At all levels of like business and large organizations, communication and transparency tends to be a massive issue. These channels, these lines are generally really poor throughout, you know, our world. So the MLS system is no exception. And we've said this, you know, for ages about like roster rules, about the TV deal, about start times, about all these different things. We just want to know why decisions are being made the way they are and what's going on behind the scenes. You can swallow almost any decision as long as you're given a rationale. Even if it's a rationale you completely disagree with, at least you're being provided, hey, listen, this is why we arrived at this decision. What's really confusing and frustrating for me, not just in sport, but also throughout the rest of life, is where you're handed decisions with no explanation, no rationale, and you're just forced to eat it and accept it. People get frustrated when that's the system. So I think if you're the Vancouver Whitecaps, that's how you're feeling a little bit at the moment, right? Is obviously they've been more involved in the process than we know about. They'll be privy to information we don't have. But nonetheless, a lot of this has felt quite opaque, especially when the players' union is coming out and you know, going against the officials' union. MLS is somewhere in between. They're all probably dealing with different sets of information. I think you just want a review and a policy that puts all the cards out on the table, gets everyone together and sort of hashes these things out. And I give credit to Vanni Sartini a couple days after the fact when he did some press and had a good chat with us. That was his message, I think, is that he realized that, hey, that wasn't the right platform for him to express his frustrations, his questions. It's more about kind of getting together, coming to the table with the referees, with the union, with the league, with the Players Association, and figuring out what the right process is. So, yeah, hopefully the league's looking into that. I think a couple of real high profile situations this playoff should press the league to look into that a little bit more seriously and maybe review how they operate their disciplinary processes.
Yeah, I think that's, again, communication, right? That's the big thing that people want. And we'll see if this will hopefully, you know, because I think ultimately that'll be the most ideal scenario, because I think at the end of the day, you also want to facilitate things for referees. And I think it also helps to be able to, you know, improve that sort of communication as well. And I think of the power of those VAR tapes as well. Like, if I'm learning from it, also the officials will be learning of, okay, how, just again, for that example, the importance of concise language, importance of certain terms, etc. So yeah, I think that's it. Transparency is the big thing. And we'll see if these incidents kind of spark it, but definitely I wonder if we'll see some sort of rethink. But yeah, now the Whitecaps will be without Vanny to start the year, and that'll certainly be strange. And certainly, yeah, Matt Miazga is a lucky guy as well. It also must be thrown in there as an aside that, I don't know, like, you could argue that entering a referee's room, a private space, you've always heard, like, ever since to go back, you don't enter that room. And to get three games, whereas, you know, Vanni Sartini, of course, again, like we said, definitely not deserving to escape without suspension. But you also do wonder, like, Miazga is a lucky guy in this scenario, and he could have easily been hit heavier. But all that to say, I think these incidents could be crucial for what's going forward, because I think it's important that sides sit down. Because I also think from the referee's perspective that they'll have reason to be like, look, we also have issues that need to be addressed. And yeah, I'm curious to see what just goes on in globally as well, because with the whole what's going on in Europe, really, it feels like a big thing's going on there. I genuinely wonder if we could see some radical changes. I've always said it, for example, I find it ludicrous that the soccer field is one of the biggest places, like biggest sporting arenas. Players are asked to run 12, 13 kilometers a game. Referees are being asked to run 12, 13 kilometers a game. Why is there not two officials? Why is there, there's enough space to have a second official. Maybe you just cover your one side, allow you to focus on that. You're not constantly running, having to be caught up with the play. You can call more tactical fouls. I wonder if that sort of experimentation should be done to help versus what we see these now, like ideas of sin bins and stuff. Like, again, I don't know if sin bins is really going to solve a big issue. Like, again, I'm not looking like tactical fouls is a big issue in the sport. Okay, maybe you could argue things like time wasting, the handball rule, etc. But I wonder if maybe issues like this could sit down. Like, could it be time to add another official into the mix and have two officials on the field, maybe a changing of the VAR process as well? I do wonder if incidents like this could spark change, because that's the unfortunate reality about this sport. Proactive changes are rare. Every once in a while, there's a new rule where you really like it. Like, I loved the rule a few years ago where they decided you could have a player in your own box on goal kicks. Remember when you couldn't be in your own box on goal kicks? And only the keeper could be. That was a ridiculous rule. And then they changed that. But other than that, a lot of these rules are, oh, the handball law isn't changing because someone decided to find a better way. It's, oh, there's all these problems with handballs. How do we adjust it? No, it didn't work. Let's adjust it again and again and again. And now this offside rule, everyone's arguing because they realize that the VAR application of a black and white rule isn't so black and white as we thought. Now you want to change the handball or the offside rule. Well, maybe some incidents like this could spark, okay, how do we actually better help the referees so that they're also equipped? Because I think that's the thing that can sometimes be forgotten, is that officials are aware of these things and they want to also perform and uphold the standard of the game, and you know, would want to be best equipped to do so and want tools like VR or potentially other avenues to do so.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add to the end of that discussion is the one other thing that Vanny said when we chatted kind of a couple days post debacle, was the one easy thing next season that MLS he thought should look to add was goal line technology. Because I mean, we saw with the Whitecaps, there were a couple moments this season where that came into play. We saw it throughout MLS. And if you're talking about the tools that the officials need, well, there's an easy one where you take stress, you take something that is very clearly black or white, if you have the technology, you take that out of the officials' hands and they have that tool they need. So I think, you know, one of the many things that Major League Soccer should probably be looking at going into next season. And it's, Alex, as we talked about, it's a quick turnaround. So time is of the essence. Putting in this kind of stuff is not usually as quick and easy as you might think. So, you know, they've got a lot of work on their hands at the league office.
100%, right? That's it's going to be a bit busy offseason in that regard, but we'll see what ends up happening there. But yeah, pretty much that's, again, feels like a big moment coming. So we'll of course see what ends up happening in that regard. But yeah, on that note, let's move on to our preseason takes. And again, we'll keep an eye out for any other news on these sort of officiating story, especially because the MLS playoffs are still not done. So of course we're at the conference finals, Columbus versus Cincinnati, and the hell is real on the Eastern side. On the Western side, no surprises, LAFC back in the conference finals against Houston, which is a bit of a surprise, but credit to both of those teams. They solid outfits. Seattle just couldn't get past Max Crepo. Of course, that'll be a bittersweet one for Whitecaps fans, but you know, maybe from Canadian fans, they'll be like, hey, look, maybe he should get a look. But of course, the Whitecaps, their season remains over. But as we mentioned earlier, we're going to dive through our preseason takes because we decided first we wanted to do some awards, right? We wanted to just look back at still what was a successful Whitecaps season and recap with some awards. But to do that, why not find our preseason takes? We make takes, right? Let's see how the season went, where our predictions were, just to get an idea. So, I mean, Sam, before I run through what we actually ended up predicting, I mean, you know, anything that when thinking back to your preseason expectations, just off the top, you know, were there anything that you look back like, okay, maybe we saw this coming about this team, and was there maybe anything that caught you by surprise as the season went along of what we didn't expect from this team?
Yeah, I think to put it as succinctly as possible, I feel like I had a good bead on where this team was going to end up, which was that sort of lower edge of the playoff table in the West, but a team with a lot of upside that, you know, had that opportunity and that, you know, showed signs of being able to move a little higher up, but maybe just couldn't quite get it done. The thing that I guess I didn't quite foresee was the variance between the offensive output and the defensive performance. I thought that this was going to be a bit more of like a middle of the pack team in both regards, where offensively they'd be decent, maybe a little bit above average, and defensively maybe right around average. In reality, this was a very good offensive team, a reasonably poor defensive team. So I think that dichotomy, I wasn't quite anticipating. I thought they'd be a little bit more middle of the table in both those areas of the pitch. So yeah, I feel like overall I had a good sense of how this team is going to perform, but maybe the way they went about it, I feel like in hindsight, I wasn't quite attuned to just how good they were going to be offensively and how much they were going to struggle defensively as well.
Well, I think, yeah, thinking back, the offensive potential was clear in this team. I think that was, and we kind of saw it, but, you know, in terms of the defensive side, that was really, if anything, I think that was a bigger surprise. Yeah, like you mentioned that, the fact that they weren't as consistent defensively. I think it was frustrating as well that they had some flashes, like that 6-game run of clean sheets, and then they weren't able to keep that up. But yeah, I think ultimately that kind of reflects in our predictions. We both did expect a good offensive team. I think we just expected maybe a little more stability defensively. But ultimately, basically what we ended up doing is we predicted results. So to start in MLS play, Sam went 6th in the West in MLS play. I went 4th in the West. I backed that since the start. They finished 6th. So Sam was bang on in that one. In terms of the Canadian Championship, we both said run it back. Weren't a fan of what TFC and Montreal offered. The Whitecaps executed. They ran it back. So that one was no nonsense. The Champions League, Sam said they would beat España, lose to an MLS team in the quarterfinals. I said they'd make the semifinals and lose there. They beat España, lost to the MLS team in the quarterfinals. So Sam really had the pulse on MLS and Champions League. And then in terms of League's Cup, Sam said they get grouped. So, of course, we knew the draw at the time, which also helped. So we weren't doing this blindly. For whatever reason, I somehow said they were going to beat LA, tie Leon, lose in the round of 32. They beat LA. They lost to Leon. They tied in the round of 32, lost on penalties. So I wasn't quite there, but close. Goal difference, Sam said +5. I said +11. They finished with +7. So Sam gets the slight edge in terms of, damn, I was sold on the defensive numbers. And Sam was a bit sold more on the low event offense. So we kind of met in the middle in that way. Then we also did some individual awards, not too many predictions. We had predicted unsung hero. Sam went for Raposo. I went for Blackman. I'd probably edge Raposo just because Blackman had a solid season, but he kind of regressed compared to where he could be. Otherwise, in terms of breakouts, Sam went Berhalter, great shout. I went for Kerifa Yao, free the boy. But Sam mentioned it in the, funnily enough, we were listening back. You mentioned that it also depended on opportunity. I thought there was going to be more opportunity. As we broke down in the last episode, there wasn't as much opportunity. So that's how that call ends up happening. And then also I had a, Sam really cleaned up on a lot of these in the predictions. So maybe he's the guru to keep an eye on at the end in the last section. But for third sub, he went Ali Ahmed, which was one of the top three candidates, as we'll discuss in the actual awards. I went with Brian White. And I thought that with Sergio Cordova coming in and the price they paid, that he was going to get a long leash, going to start, and that someone like White, like we saw with Cavallini, where he kind of ended up being relegated to a, you know, mixed role, that White might end up being more of a sub and that he would thrive as a sub. Turns out he'd thrive as a starter and Cordova would be shipped out by August. So I bit hard on the Cordova stock. So yeah, well, I mean, Sam, looking back at that, anything in particular that kind of stood out from those picks?
Sure. Well, I think one of the first things that comes to mind for me is really how, despite the fact that I happened to get it right, how insignificant the MLS regular season placement felt. Because really, whether the Whitecaps were third or seventh in the West, all those teams were so close this season that it just felt like a bit of a luck of the draw on the final match day. So I honestly, I feel like your prediction of fourth just as accurate and valuable as mine in six. They were right in that range. A lot of factors played into that that didn't have a lot to do with the quality of team. It would have been different if one of us had gone eighth, if one of us had gone first. Okay, now we're talking significant differences. But to me, they were right in that range. So I feel like we got that right. And really for all the competitions, we were right in the correct range. So I feel like we did a good job there collectively. Ditto goes for the goal difference. Again, you know, a significant improvement on last season. Exactly how good they were going to be above that, you know, above neutral, above that zero goal difference. We weren't entirely sure, but we were in the right track. When it comes to the individual awards, I mean, I don't know if there was a great unsung hero candidate this season. I guess maybe, you know, unsung and breakout can often maybe kind of fall in the same category. So I feel like Berhalter was probably one of those guys who had a bigger role than anticipated. You know, I feel like Raposo, it wasn't a regression year, but it also wasn't a massive step forward. So really both of us with our unsungs, Raposo and Blackman, that probably wasn't as great as it could have been. You know, yeah, with Yao, the breakout, it's just tough because he wasn't provided the opportunity. And then, you know, with the third sub with Ahmed and White, there's both guys that had tremendous years. And I would say funny how really both of us with our third sub of the year predictions, those guys had much bigger roles than expected. I mean, even though Ali only started about 50% of his matches, it felt like he was much more of a regular contributor than a third sub type player by the end of the season. So overall, I feel like we had a pretty decent feel for the team, but obviously there's things that happen out of your control, beyond your expectations. Like I was not anticipating. I did an article at the start of the season where I did, I think, starters, like a starting 11 by sort of my percentage of confidence that they'd be a starter throughout the season. And I put Matias Laborda at like a 90 or 95%. That didn't age very well. And that explains part of my thought process behind them being a little bit better defensively than they were. Obviously, that didn't happen. So, you know, I feel like not a lot of change is really going to change. It depends on the offseason, obviously. But going into next year, I look at these predictions and I think I would probably recycle a lot of these takes. It's going to depend how they tune around the edges, something we can talk about too, you know, does that fourth designated player spot enter the conversation? How does that change the picture for Vancouver? But I feel like this is about where this team's going to be next season as well. So yeah, overall, I feel like we did a decent job, but obviously, you know, the listeners, let us know what you thought this team was going to be going into this season and how you feel like we did in terms of our prediction.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to do maybe next year. This could be a third sub project as in the writing side. Maybe we could get a general poll of predictions.
Get the Google forms going, have some people throw their hat in the ring with predictions. That would be a good time.
I feel like it would be fun to revisit, be like, all right, who was buying, who was pessimistic, who, you know, I think that could be a fun exercise. So maybe that'll be something to remember. But yeah, no, I think ultimately, I think it's fair. I think this, we look back, I think this, it's nice because I think this team about hit the level that they were expected to. I think that's the big thing. And that's good because you don't want an underperformance. Of course, you would love an overperformance, even though statistically those aren't always sustainable, but you'd love it. You'd love what St. Louis did, right? Just you go on and win the West and, you know, forget XG, just vibe. But no, I think this was a fair assessment of how the season was going to go. And I think it's good because it sets up for next year as well that, okay, they can build off this. There isn't going to be much change. And yeah, I'm curious to see what happens now because next year, it feels like really it's going to be a make or break year. It feels like so many guys, you're going to get prime performances. You look at the contract situations, et cetera. The fact they're in Champions League again, a chance to make a run. You're in Leagues Cup again. You want them, you know, to get a three-peat in Canadian Championship. How special would that be to get a three-peat? Like there's a lot at stake next year. So I'm excited for that. But of course, our last reflection of this year will be postseason awards and postseason as in the season's over, not awards for just the postseason because you don't have much to give away from just two games of postseason action. But enough of the confusion of those two words. We'll roll through these pretty relatively quickly just because I don't think there's all too much debate for some of them. Of course, there are some. We'll probably dive in a little deeper. But let's start with the first no-brainer, right? The classic, the one we do every year. And for once, it really feels like there was no argument. The MVP award. And I mean, pretty much, Sam, I'll throw it to you. This can only be one player, one player's award, and I think we know what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I threw this in our 86 Forever / third sub preseason predictions. I went contrarian and I went with Julian Gressel. Everyone else did Ryan Gallman. You know, halfway through the season, I wasn't feeling so bad about that. Obviously, forces conspired against me. But even so, what Ryan Gall did in the second half of the season, I've said it on the podcast before, I think that is the absolute peak level any Vancouver Whitecaps player has achieved in the MLS era. You know, we're talking about a top five player in the league during the second half of the season. So there's no debate. The goals plus assists, the work rate off the ball, the tackles, the leadership, the attitude, just everything about Ryan Gall in the second half of the season was first rate. So it's got to be the easiest MVP to hand out. I mean, I remember early in the Mark Dos Santos era, you'd get to the end of the season, it was kind of like, okay, who? I don't know. We got to give someone this MVP award, but thankful that we don't have that kind of thing going on anymore. So yeah, massive ups to the Scott. It was a tremendous, tremendous season that the only possible quibble would have been just, you would have loved to see that second half throughout. And you wonder where the Whitecaps could have been if that's what they were able to get all season long.
Well, especially in those first 2 months, but no, it's a no-brainer. Like Ryan Gold, he got snubbed from the best 11. Let's throw that out there. I think again, the best 11 was quite something. I just found it quite hilarious that I was privileged enough to vote for the best 11. I think 5 out of 11 of my players made it in. Again, I mean, some of my picks, maybe they were a bit outrageous, so maybe I'm not the best gauge of what a best 11 looks like, but I'm just like, wow, usually in most leagues you put out a best 11, there's a general consensus. But I mean, hey, it's something where, you know, it's a name-based vote. For example, Hani Mukhtar, like could you argue that Ryan Gall ended up having a better, more consistent season than him? Yeah, and yet someone like Hani Mukhtar makes it in. I wasn't actually as outraged by the Walker Zimmerman shout, by the way, somewhere, because Nashville still had some very good defensive metrics. He was their most used defender. But that's a whole other debate. But for example, the fact that guys like Alvaro Barreal didn't make it in is absurd and a story for another day. But anyways, all that to say that Ryan Gold was in that discussion. Ryan Gold, you saw the goal contribution numbers. You just saw the times he would take this team on his back. You could argue that there's a discussion we made for Brian White as well, but it's just the way that Gold took the team on his back. This was his team, and it felt like it. And, you know, you add in the working class MVP, the hard work off the ball, everything about it, wearing, taking on the captain's armband. He really stepped up this year, and I'm excited to see what he can do next year. Full off season, get healthy, be ready to go and maybe really do some damage, especially in the, you know, early on in the season. Cause I think the Whitecaps need a hot start, and, you know, maybe being without their coach for six games either will be a blessing or a curse in that regard. But either, no matter who's behind the bench, you're going to need your players to step up, and we'll expect that from Gold. But yeah, it's certainly a lot easier this year. We've been doing this for 4 years, by the way, I checked, since 2020. And in 2020, we were sitting here thinking, all right, does Freddie Montero's six goals after being exiled count as MVP, or does Lucas Cavallini, because he scored in three games in a row, count as the MVP? So it is, we've come a long way. But one word that never changes, we've always had fun with this one, is the unsung hero. And this one's a tough one. Because there's a lot of quiet contributors, I think, in a season like this one. You know, a lot of players that might have flown under the radar, you know, especially because the Whitecaps used a lot of depth. So, I mean, Sam, for this one, I'll throw it to you first. Who is your 2023 unsung hero?
Okay, so this is interesting because I kind of look at unsung player of the year, breakout player, you know, and those, to me, a bit sometimes fall into the same, they get similar grouping of players, right? But, oh, what am I going to do here? What am I going to do? And also, we got to talk about Defender of the Year upcoming, because I think that one's a bit of a dicey one. So, okay, I think I've sorted out my mind. I'm going to go off the bat here. Seb Berhalter, I think unsung hero, unsung player of the year for me, because as we got near the end of the season, really, Berhalter could be relied upon to fill in for Andres Kubas, one of the best defensive midfielders in the league. And it felt at times like the Whitecaps didn't miss a beat. Obviously, you're not getting the same level from Seb you're getting from Andres Kubas, but the drop-off wasn't significant. And for a young domestic midfielder, I think that is a huge compliment. He already showed signs last season. He was trending in the right direction, but it felt like Seb went from a guy who you saw as a potentially impactful MLS contributor, and he just became a real quality player for the team. That's something, I mean, they haven't, I don't believe Alex announced a new contract yet, so that's one you want to see them ink him up soon. As you mentioned, I mean, he might be looking for a role somewhere as a starter in MLS. You know, he could probably say to the Whitecaps, listen, I know Kubas is in my way here. Why shouldn't I go somewhere else where I think I could be a starter? I think that's a fair question. So for me, unsung hero, and we'll talk about some of the other players. I'm going to mention a few probably that could have fit into this category as well as we go on.
Yeah, I think there's two ways of going about it. For example, if I were just to say, I could argue Andres Kubas, because I think the fact that it was always the White and Gold show, and, you know, even elsewhere in the lineup, like a lot was celebrated about the emergence of Pedro Vite, or, you know, of course, the breakout, well-deserved breakout of Ali Ahmed. Even when Yohei Takaoka was going through his good streak, he got a lot of love, you know, the likes of Ranko, the new guys out of Kubilarea, yet the one constant throughout everything that we saw this season from the start to the end was Andres Kubas. And I feel like he's genuinely something that if he played on a different team, he could be sneaking into like a MLS best 11, like if he was playing in the right team, just if people talked about him more, just because of how dominant he can be for this Whitecaps team. So I'd say Andres Kubas, but also he's a DP. It's hard to be unsung as a DP. So I will leave him out. I'm just thinking that in terms of maybe more of an MLS recognition standpoint, he might be one of the most unsung players in the league. For the Whitecaps, I'm going to go Ali Ahmed, though. Just, I feel like it's kind of not talked about, but whenever he was playing and in his best form, it kind of felt like the Whitecaps were in their best form. Like when he had that early, you know, before his injury against Pacific, he had a really good run and the Whitecaps were on it. That was kind of some of their best stretches of the season, was around that May, June, where they kind of figured it out. And Ali Ahmed was central in that. He found his new position. There were some injuries at the time, but he stepped up and just completely helped the Whitecaps. And then later in the season, when they had their huge unbeaten run and pushed up in the top four, despite playing all those road games, Ali Ahmed put in some big shifts along that. And it kind of felt like when he was at his best, the Whitecaps were kind of thriving off that. And you wouldn't think that this was technically someone who was in his first full year with the team, just because he was playing more with the second team last year. And of course, on a team with Gold, White, Vite, all these names I mentioned, you kind of didn't realize how much he actually did stir this drink. And I think heading into next year, it's exciting because if they can really give him the proper role to showcase himself, it could be a real, even more of a breakout season than we saw. So I'd say Ahmed, just because, of course, everyone was aware with his breakout. He got called up to Canada. He got a lot of due praise. But I just don't think that, like, it felt like it was almost framed as like a good success development story where you don't kind of realize that, okay, maybe he was a lot more influential than we realized, and he could really take a big step forward next year.
Yeah, broadly, I totally agree with that. And I'll probably have something similar to say here about Ali in a couple moments. Okay. Let's move on to defender of the year. If you have nothing to add, I don't care. I'm going off the board here. Andres Kubas is my defender of the year. Seriously, you look at the defensive line. Joey Takaoka, not consistent enough. Branko Veselinovic, I think a good player, but limited in terms of what he can provide. We've talked about that. Aerial duels, just being that, you know, real take charge leader of the back line. Blackman, as you said, regressed a little bit. Laborda didn't have the impact we were hoping for. Jermaine Brown, inconsistent. To me, when Vancouver had that defensive streak, when they were looking really good, whenever Vancouver was able to keep clean sheets, whenever they looked like they were locking things down at the back, it was because of one player, and one player almost alone. I won't say alone, but damn near close, and it was Andres Kubas. That destroy and progress, that brick wall, giving other teams midfield just a heck of a time trying to create. We saw teams playing down the flanks, hitting balls into the box in a hopeful manner because they knew they couldn't get past Kubas at the time. So to me, it's a bit off the board, but he's my defender.
Yeah, it's like, can I pick Ryan Gold's pressing as well? Like... Yeah, really looking at the defenders of the year, it's either a mix of too inconsistent, didn't play enough, because genuinely I feel like maybe if he'd gotten more of a run, someone like Richie Larea could be an underrated shout in that regard, or like a Sam Adekugbe, but they came halfway through. Jermaine Brown, Luis Martins, just too inconsistent. Blackman, Veselinovic, Laborda. If I were to pick a defender just to honor the award, I'd probably go Blackman still, because even though he regressed, it felt like he was probably the most consistent of the defenders, just because Ranko, you know, was relatively, you know, a bit more inconsistent just in terms of what when he was at his best and when he wasn't. So if I were to be true to that one, I'd go Blackman. But yeah, I think if you're going to argue best defensive player, maybe we'll have to reword this if there's another season like this next year. I'd 100% agree on Andres Kubas. Not much to add on that one. Let's move on to departure of the year.
One thing I would just add to your, I think pointing out Blackman is probably the best of the back line is a good one, because maybe this is not the best metric to how you evaluate defenders. I think especially with like advanced metrics is still a big discussion. It's hard. But to me, Tristan Blackman had the most like goal-saving interventions of any Whitecaps defender. He had a number of notable moments of that critical tackle, that critical block. And so I think, you know, one metric's probably as good as any in that respect, and Blackman would probably come out with the edge in that regard. Maybe if it came to consistency, it would be Ranko, but again, I just feel like there's limitations there. So, sorry, we can move on now to the next category.
Well, that's it. It's a good discussion to have, right? Like, how do you value defending? Is it good to be low event? Is it good to be high event? Is it good to be mid event? Is it good to be good on the ball? Is it good? It's one day we'll figure out a better way to properly assess defenders. I definitely think it's funny. Like, it feels like, you know, you can judge attackers a lot more on numbers, goalkeepers on numbers, midfielders, but defenders is one where I think it genuinely might be the most eye test affected position. And that's, it makes for some interesting discussion. But if, yes, departure of the year, for those unfamiliar with this award, it's basically a departure within the last 6 to 12 months that hurt the team the most. This one was a bit harder though, because we looked back and there weren't actually really that many big departures in the sense of, like, yes, Cavallini left, but that one was kind of like writing on the wall. You look at the likes of a Janio Bickel leaving, Leo Owusu, Marcus Cedinho. You're losing some decent players, yes, but it's not like, you know, of course you could argue losing it to St. Ricketts was definitely one of them. But ultimately, it's the departure that we felt was missed the most. I'm going to start with a bit of a fun one, just because I think there's an obvious answer here. And I'll let Sam take care of that one, just because it fits on, you know, it fits his theme of some of his earlier picks. But I'll start with one. And I think this is a bit of a loophole, yes, because technically he didn't play at all last year. But I think losing Derek Cornelius in hindsight is one where you look like, man, if you could only find a way to make it work. Because he goes to Malmö in Sweden. They win the title. He puts up a dominant season. Playing in the middle of a back three, you think, oh man, the Whitecaps struggle to get consistency when in the middle of the back threes, winning a lot of aerial duels. Think about the Whitecaps struggling with aerial duels in the middle of their back three. You know, a lefty, they don't really have many lefties as well at the back. They're trying to shoehorn guys like Luis Martins in just for lefties at the back. You think of just what Cornelius could have brought. I think this one, it's tough because ultimately, he wasn't coming back. He got his taste of Europe. He made a good move. I think one that helped his national team career. And hopefully that can help lead him start more for the national team. But it just, it's like Sam kind of mentioned before the show, it makes you wonder, like, man, if they could have only nurtured Cornelius better from 2019 to now, what they could have had. Because, man, he's like, he's in his prime now, right? Or not even, he's entering. He's only 26, which for a center back is still like a good age. You wonder what they could have done if they nurtured him, got him in the system, got used to him. But, you know, he ended up getting sent on loan to Greece. And since then, the writing's been kind of on the wall. So you wonder if they could have found a way to make it work. So I went with Cornelius, but there's an obvious choice. And I'll let Sam take it.
Well, so I think there's a couple interesting ones here. Obviously, Julian Gressel departing mid-season, right? That's a big one. Kind of doesn't fit into, like, the off-season narrative. But then also Kyle Alexandre only played 4 matches last year, but at least was in the mix there. And I think when you look in terms of profile of player that really would have thrived in this system, that's a big shout. And obviously Kyle now, you know, in the news and very much in demand in South America. So I think those two midfielders, right? Now Ali Ahmed's kind of stepping into that role. And so maybe you don't miss them that much. Weirdly, Alex, I think here's one that's comes with a ton of caveats and a ton of what ifs, but looking at the whiff on the Sergio Cordova signing, given the fact they couldn't find the right striker, if you could have somehow brought back Lucas Cavallini at a reduced rate, not at his option rate, which was like 2 million and completely ridiculous, but if you could have brought back Cava for like 800K or something like that, I feel like that wouldn't have been a terrible striker pickup. So I feel like, you know, the Whitecaps did suffer a little bit in the second half of the season. If it wasn't Brian White kind of poaching, scoring goals, who was it going to be? Simon Becher fell off the face of the earth. Levante Johnson not quite ready. They didn't necessarily have a second guy. And so, you know, I think Cava comes with a lot of issues and a lot of question marks, but I do feel like they missed that second striker a little bit. So that's an outside shout, but I feel like Gressel and then by some extension, Kyle Alexandre at that 8 is someone that they definitely missed in the second half of the season. Although, you know, the way Gall played, the way that Brian White played sort of papered over a lot of that. And also, you know, shout out to Pedro Vite for stepping in and doing a much better job in a more box-to-box role. But I would say those two guys together, that's probably what was missed most, especially in the second half of the season.
Yeah, I'll always say the biggest irony is that 22 Whitecaps, they played the perfect style for Sergio Cordova and not so much Lucas Cavallini. And that this 23 Whitecaps didn't play a style that better suited Lucas Cavallini and not Sergio Cordova. Imagine if they got those two. Imagine if they had Cordova in 22 and maybe I think Cavallini would have fit the system a bit more of, okay, not having to constantly be playing so vertical, being able to drop and take his touches, more crosses into the box, etc. I think this could have really suited his system where versus last year was so vertical, which is what Cordova is good at. So horribly ironic. Hopefully they find the right striker that can do what they need for the system next year. But moving through the awards nearing the end here, it got most improved. So that one, very subjective because you could go anywhere to, you know, say Ryan Gold had a big improvement on his season. But of course, it's someone who was around the year before who took a big improvement. So I'll let you start with this one.
Well, yeah. So for me, I think this one's Ali Ahmed for a bunch of the reasons that you already listed. I think I really like the point you made that a lot of people are sort of treating this like, he was a promising player in the system. And that Ali Ahmed's progression was sort of expected or self-evident. But to go from, you know, not even part of an academy passed over to Whitecaps FC2, Whitecaps FC2 player of the year, come to the first team, show some flashes. And then all of a sudden, that was already huge jumps year after year. But this season, to go from interesting young player who's shown a bit of promise to this might be like a genuinely really good box-to-box midfielder who could be an impact player for the national team going forward if they use him in the right way. Like, that is a massive jump in one season. And I just don't feel like even, you know, the Whitecaps were only scratching the surface really of what they could do with him. I feel like this offseason is going to be massive for Vanny in terms of figuring out what they really have in Ali and how to, they don't have Julian Gressel anymore. There's no Kyle Alexandre. They could even, you know, conceivably move on from someone like Pedro Vite if he has different aspirations, if he doesn't fit the system. I feel like Ali's poised even for another jump forward. And we might not even see that progression fully until 2024. So for me, that's the most improved. I almost wanted to shout out like a weird outside one would be Brian White, because I think we knew he was a streaky scorer. We knew he had ability to be an impactful MLS player and an elite goal scorer, but we hadn't seen that over the course of a full season. And we saw that this year. So it's kind of weird, a guy that's already established to say that he's most improved, but that's like an underrated outside shout, I think, as well.
Yeah, it's a good one. I mean, this is someone that was in the Golden Boot race, 15 plus goals, all non-penalty goals. That's a good season for any striker in the world. Like, that's something where if he takes penalties, he's a 25 goal scorer. And then all of a sudden you're talking, whoa, like that's elite, right? So the White one's a good shout, especially because he cleaned up his hold-up play. I think I like the Ahmed shout. Pedro Vite also could have gotten a shout just because he improved a lot defensively. That's the thing. Like, Vite always had the offensive talent, but he got this work rate, etc. Ultimately, I'm going to go with, funny enough, I think we swapped from our unsung. I'm going to go with Sebastian Berhalter. I just feel like what he did in terms of, you know, it felt like last year at times, you're kind of like, Berhalter has a lot of upside, but where does he fit? What's his best position? Is he an 8 or a 6? Because there's a lot of sloppiness defensively. And I think just the maturity he added and provided to that position, which is a tough position, I just really like the way he improved. So it's definitely a shout to, you know, shout to be given to Ahmed and Vite. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like Ahmed and Vite as well were kind of already on the cusp of being starters heading into this year. Like, they already had a big role. That's why it's hard to say is like the breakout player. Because for me, Berhalter, genuinely heading into this year, this was a very prove that you can be reliable depth. And now you're looking like, okay, this is someone that could be a starter somewhere and you might struggle to keep a hold on him. I think that's a big improvement for him. And one that I think Berhalter is most improved.
Yeah, well, why don't we just move on to third sub of the year? Because honestly, it's the same two guys. If you kind of go by the starts to matches played metric, really, you're looking at Seb Berhalter, 28 matches played, only 11 starts. Ali Ahmed, 22 matches played, 12 starts. Then I don't want to make the Simon Betcher fanboys mad, so. Simon Betcher, 19 matches played, 5 starts, obviously 4 goals, 1 assist, but really no impact in the second half of the season. So for me, that's a little bit disqualifying. I mean, worth shouting out as well, Seb Berhalter, 2 goals, 2 assists. Like, kind of, you're not really, I don't think that that's what you're looking for from Berhalter. Like, goals and assists are nice from a defensive midfielder, but you're not relying on that. So that's an underrated shout as well. So I think in absence of a Toss Ricketts type, you know, Levante Johnson didn't play enough to be that marauding energy striker. Junior Hoilett maybe would have been a prime candidate if he played the full season, but we didn't see enough. Against Simon Betcher, he was on pace certainly early in the season, but that just completely tapered off. So I think Berhalter, you know, a name we've been saying a lot during these awards, but he's my third sub.
Yeah, I think I'll just go Berhalter just because by definition he fit a lot more of the third sub in the sense he was also started to be relied upon to come in and
No one, though, really was that true prototypical, all right, it's the 85th minute, time to bring X on. But Vanny really moved around, changed things up. There wasn't that one guy who always came off the bench to provide energy.
basically there's no Ricketts or Raposa this year because shout out to Raposa, the original third sub winner,
He
a two-time
he's
winner.
graduated full effectively now. It's no longer a thing.
And then, of course, Ricketts retired. Who was our other one? I want to say that, like, wasn't it like Patrick Metcalf in 2021 or something like that? Because, and hey, he's done pretty well since. So I think either way, the fact that it's ultimately, either Ali Ahmed or Seb Berhalter, I'd say that bodes pretty well for them as a pair of youngsters. I think I just would lean Berhalter because I think Ahmed was more entrenched as a starter, and it was weird. Like it felt like he was a starter. It's just like anytime he wouldn't start, you're like, whoa, right? Like you're just kind of like you knew he was going to bring an impact off the bench, but always felt wrong for him to not start. But then also a bunch of his appearances on the bench were because of injuries. Like he had that little period where he was having those niggles and couldn't start anyways. Whereas Berhalter, he had to make with the fact that he's behind a very good six, made the most of it, forced his way into games off the bench. I think he was just more of a prototypical third sub than Ahmed. So I lean Berhalter there. But last two awards, well, these ones are a bit more fun. Goal of the year, game of the year. Let's start with goal of the year. This one's a bit tougher because the Whitecaps, man, they didn't score and they don't score enough golassos. So that's the one they will say. Like, it's good to get the high XG shots and whatnot. So, like, you can't fault the process, but it's good to have some shots from distance every now and then because, you know, maybe it's not as analytical, but it helps draw out defenses. It keeps goalkeepers alert. It opens up dangerous passing lanes if teams know you're a threat from distance. But unfortunately, the Whitecaps don't have much of that. They also didn't really score many acrobatic shouts, so there wasn't. You don't have at least bicycle kicks, etc. There's still some good candidates. I have my choice. I think my choice is Pedro Vita against Tigres. Just the way the ball bounced to him, chest volley, top corner, big game, big opponent, early in a match, get the crowd going. Of course, I was lucky enough to watch it, so maybe I was a bit biased by seeing it in person. But for me, it was a Pedro Vita one. You can give a shout to Ahmed versus LAFC at the end, that half volley. There's some other good strikes from distance from Seb Berhalter, but I think Pedro Vita's Tigres strike just took it for me.
Yeah, I can't go away from that. I think just in terms of the quality of the strike, the opponent early in the match, it kind of hits all the marks. I would just say in general, looking through some of the goals, a lot of really nice build-up play, play in transition, just you know, nice passing that we wouldn't have seen from a 2018, 2020 Whitecaps team. So that was fantastic. But as you mentioned, not a lot of acrobatic or just, you know, absolute thumpers of strikes. We're saying Seb Berhalter a lot. So, you know, outside shout for the St. Louis goal. It was from outside of the box. But I don't know if the goalkeeper really covered himself in glory on that one. So I think that's a little bit disqualifying. I would also give an honorable mention to really any of like the give and go Brian White, Ryan Gauld goals that inevitably ended up with Gauld whipping it across and White on the end of it with a header. Those were just always, I think, very competent quality goals. But I think in terms of the memorability factor, Pedro Vite has to be the leader in the clubhouse for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a fair choice. But yeah, maybe we'll have to make a build-up goal of the year category, because I do agree some of these build-ups were exceptionally nice and do deserve to be applauded. That's why that Ali Ahmed goal too, because I'm pretty sure it was a nice build-up leading up to it as well. Like, it's a very good candidate if you're looking at the overall aspects. Lastly, game of the year. This one's always tough, because I know some years we were blessed. Like, there was, you know, Vancouver, San Jose 4-3. I think we picked that one year. At least I did, even though the Whitecaps lost, just because it was an amazing game. Like, you can't, like, you know, that's MLS is back heritage. Like, I still see people on Twitter reference that game who aren't even Whitecaps fans, right? Like, that's just unhinged chaos. This year, there weren't really that many, like, unhinged, like, pure, uncut MLS games, if you know what I mean. But there's still, you know, a few. Ultimately, I went for, there's two choices really for me. My honorable mention was the 2-1 Montreal in the final, just because I think that was the best the Whitecaps have ever played in a game of that magnitude, where they were just springing the ball around the park. They were on the front foot, but then they kind of almost threw it away at the end. So it just lost a bit of allure. So ultimately I went with one that was kind of insignificant if you think back, but I think a reminder of what this team really could have been if everything fell into place. It was 6-2 against Houston, because, man, they were dominant in that game. And they beat up a good Houston team that's currently in the conference finals, right? Like, this is a good Houston team. This isn't just like beating up on a Colorado and calling it a day. No, they blew the doors off one of the best teams in the league this year, 6-2 at home, and it was done. They could have won by more. They made it hard for themselves for no reason by, you know, allowing a pair of goals, which, funnily enough, I feel like this really epitomizes what this team was, like, inconsistent defensively, but, man, when they clicked offensively on their day, and, like, all the goals were nice in this game, too. It was cutbacks, good finishes. Julian Gressel had a nice goal in this game, if I'm not mistaken. Ryan Gauld as well broke a slump at the time. Zien scored in a hot minute. Like, this was just a fun game, so I'm going Houston 6-2.
Yeah, I like it. That's a good one. I'm going to kind of run down the leaderboard here, essentially, just the games that stood out to me. So obviously that Houston victory is one. I think in a similar style, the big home win over CF Montreal, obviously early red card, but Simon Betcher and Ali Ahmed doing no wrong in that match, just going off, I think will be very memorable, even if the quality of football wasn't amazing. I would say kind of the same thing. One match that stands out to me is at the start of that big long road trip away in Portland, squeaking out the 3-2 victory. It started a team that wasn't able to win on the road. It gave them that confidence and momentum. So I think that one's memorable. And when you're talking about sort of chaotic, memorable matches, I think that Portland one, an away victory would stand out. And then another away victory would be the win over LAFC on the road as well, where they were able to squeak it out 3-2. That's a big one for me. So I think in terms of maybe being memorable, I would go with the CF Montreal, but in terms of the quality of football, probably, you know, securing the win down in LA, especially given the fact that they were eliminated in multiple competitions by LAFC. That's, in terms of quality result, that's probably the top one, but I might remember the win over CF Montreal the most. Outside shout as well, late season victory over St. Louis, even though they were kind of cruising near the end of the season, 3-0 at home, I think that's a quality result as well.
Yeah, and I think if to throw one more, I think Tigres. Yes, they didn't win, but I think that really gave them a lot of confidence heading into the second half or the back end of the season, that they went up a team against a team like that, and they went toe to toe.
Honestly, both League's Cup matches against Liga MX teams, Leon and Tigres, were good performances.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a good choice of that. But yes, that's our fourth annual Third Sub Awards. So always a pleasure to dive in and give out some virtual hardware, and yeah, maybe we'll have to do something special for the 50th year of awards, potentially next year. But for now, because we don't have enough predictions, and you know, it's right now, it's the calm before the storm, right? Like, it feels like over the next few weeks, the super drafts in a few weeks, MLS Cup's going to be giving out all the re-entry drafts, all that good stuff's going to be taken care of. The transfer window is going to open. Feels like this is going to be the last kind of quiet period in MLS for a bit, at least for the Whitecaps. So we thought, why not have some way too early bold predictions that we can look back on in a while and laugh at, or, you know, be like, man, we should have maybe ran to the lottery with these sorts of predictions. Basically, what we decided to do is just have three bold predictions. You can't have too many bold predictions, or they're not really that bold. You're just kind of throwing rocks at a wall and hoping one of them somehow sticks. Basically, we set three categories: the bold player prediction, so something about a player next year. It could be anything. It can be, you know, this player is going to play 5 or 2,000 minutes, or, you know, this player scores this amount of goals. This player leaves, like, it could be so something like that. Then it's competition prediction, so something related to the Whitecaps in a competition next year. And then an off-season prediction, so something transaction related. So that last one's probably going to be the hardest, but yeah, three categories. I think it's fair.
All right, here we go. I'm excited for this. Some of these might be wacky, but I'm going all in. So the first one, fitting into that all-in theme, is I'm going to go Brian White eclipses his 2023 goal total in 2024. I just feel like this is a player in the prime of his MLS career. He understands the league. He understands what he can do. He has the qualities to make it happen, and he has the support in Orion Gall to make it happen. I also think Richie Larea, if he stays, Sam Adekubi, they're able to add another attacking weapon of some variety into the mix. I also think Vanni Sartini is going to evolve this team tactically. I'm buying the Whitecaps in terms of offensive output going into 2024. I think that the other end of the pitch, the defensive stuff, is a big question mark, but the Whitecaps, I believe, will score plenty of goals next season, and Brian White will be a huge part of that.
All right. That's a solid one. I'm kind of torn between a few. I'm going to go screwed. It's bold. It's not exactly supposed to be. I'm not supposed to look back like, man, I was like, you know, there's a more element of risk. I'm going to go Yohei Takaoka gets 10 clean sheets next year. And I'm saying that because second year in MLS, he gets a chance to, you know, get familiar. He learned a lot about travel, physicality, mistakes, etc. I was pleased with how he ended the season. So that was a sign of a player that's growing and adapting. And also, I just think the backline in front of him, it feels like there's going to be some changes, right? Like, it feels like they're going to get that revamp they need. Perhaps a fourth DP comes in, right? And they invest at the center back position. So I don't know. It just feels like this defense is due a bit of a rebuild. And I think the goalkeeper will benefit from that, right? Because Takaoka facing less danger will make his life a lot easier. So I think I'd say 10 clean sheets. I'd love to be bold and be like, he gets nominated for goalkeeper of the year, but he's going to need to have an otherworldly season, because it's always going to go to the likes of, you know, the bigger names like, you know, Berkey, Blakes, et cetera. Like, it kind of always, you know, ends up being. But I think a 10 clean sheet season is my bold prediction. I think that someone like Taco could really benefit from how maybe the Whitecaps, you know, because you look at this roster, they can look and be like, okay, yes, we need a striker potentially of the DP variety. But other than that, like, there's not much other cosmetic makeover they need to do up front. Most of their work's going to be reshoring that back line, and perhaps Taco can benefit from it in this second season.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. I can see it going either way, where they even maybe look at bringing in another keeper, or I can see Takaoka having a massive second season and really figuring it out. I think that one's very much on the fence. I'd encourage people, if you haven't checked it out, go check out Caleb's article on the third sub about Yohei Takaoka. Is he good enough? I think a pretty sober, realistic assessment of both Takaoka's limitations and also the opportunity cost of going after another keeper. Is it really worth the Whitecaps' while? So would encourage you to check that out. as I said, I could see it going both ways. Okay, going on to the bold competition prediction. This is one that brings me no joy, Alex. I really hope I am incorrect about this one. But I'm going to say that something gives in the Canadian Championship. Maybe it's the Whitecaps do really well in CONCACAF, and they're on a deep run. They're having a great MLS season, and something in the Canadian Championship just falls by the wayside, whether it's another Canadian Premier League team or one of TFC or Montreal in the final. I just feel three in a row, as much as I really think this team's capable of it and probably should do it, it just feels like, you know, maybe a red card, a controversial penalty decision, something goes the wrong way and they're unable to complete the three-peat. So I don't know if that's bold or not, but that's my bold competition prediction, because I feel like they could make a little bit of noise in CONCACAF. I based on those League's Cup performances, I feel like that they're buoyed a little bit in the continental competition, and maybe that distracts them a bit from their own domestic stuff.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm struggling to see what way to lean with this. I'm going to go, because of the West, again, the West remains a jungle. St. Louis, like, no idea what to expect from them in year two, especially because of the famed word that a lot of people hate, regression. Even LAFC, another deep run in the playoffs, potentially more CONCACAF next year. You know, guys like Carlos Vela aging out. Also, Seattle looks like they're about to go through a mini rebuild of sorts. Ladero leaving, Rui Diaz potentially leaving. Whitecaps win the West. I don't know if they'll, you know, I could also see them, they would be very Whitecaps to win the West and lose in the first round of playoffs. So that's why I'm just saying win the West and not going anywhere else. But I think the Whitecaps take that step forward in league play and kind of be like, okay, like, this just, it's time to really make a run in the league, start strong, finally take advantage of the fact that, yeah, like, genuinely, you look at the Western Conference, I'm even thinking now Portland could do a job, but they're also going to need some big signings, because they've got obviously made a coaching change. You look at across the board, Houston, I think, is maybe one where they could be the team to watch in that regard. And I think maybe Houston's the favorites to top the West. But I'm looking, other than that, yeah, a lot of the big teams, it feels like that's a bit of a transition year. Houston, RSL, Vancouver, it's kind of open for those three to take a big jump, in my opinion. And of course, knowing MLS, someone like the Galaxy or Minnesota is going to finish top three just because, you know, there's always some team near the bottom that makes some huge jump out of nowhere. But for the Whitecaps, I think it could be something where they finish first in the West. But I'd say, as a side thing to throw it in, they do that, it comes at a cost. Like, I think they either lose a CAN champ or they flop out of a CONCACAF Champions League, but they end up getting rewarded with a good showing in regular season play.
That's exactly how I was going to almost add that to my Canadian Championship predictions. I feel like the Whitecaps do really well in MLS play. And that, again, that just, we see this with all these teams that either go on CONCACAF runs, go on US Open Cup runs. You can't do well in all competitions at the same time. It comes at a cost. So I think they'll do well in MLS. I don't know if I'm going to go first in the West. Well, I mean, we're going to see in the preseason. We'll do
it's bold, right?
We'll do some predictions. I'll have to, you know, I'll get in the lab and calculate. But I do think they'll be up there. I'll guarantee at this point, I will predict them to finish higher than sixth in the West, unless they really mess up their offseason roster moves, which is a great transition for us to get into a bold offseason prediction. Okay, Alex, I'm going to go with this one. I try to make it extra spicy, and we'll see how it turns out. My bold offseason prediction is that the Whitecaps move on from transfer both Ranko Veselinovic and Pedro Vite. I think the first one, the Ranko one, to me, as much as I like Ranko as a player in many respects, I think if they're going to go through that little bit of a defensive rebuild, if they're going to take a big step forward, he just doesn't seem like the right fit. I think if they want to rebuild the defensive identity, that involves focusing on Tristan Blackman, Matias Laborda, and another center back who isn't Ranko Veselinovic as the core of that defensive unit. So I think kind of like a Julian Gressel, that's one where you have a good player, but you want to bring in a great player, or you want to bring in someone who's a great fit. And I feel like they've sort of stalled out on what they can do with the player. So that one to me is obvious. The Pedro Vite one is tough because, man, I love Pedro as a player, and I want him to be a, you know, 8-goal, 8-assist guy in Vancouver, 10-goal, 10-assist guy in Vancouver, and then make a massive move to a big club. But again, I think just with Reingold there, you know, if Junior Hoyle is going to stay around for another season, you have a lot of attacking midfield types. If Richie Larea is back and you're trying to work through him offensively. If you bring in another midfielder, if Ali Ahmed's going to be a day-to-day starter as a number 8, I just wonder where Pedro's role is. And as much as I'd like to see him take that jump in Vancouver and then move on, I wonder if now might be the right time for him just to find another fit. So those are very contingent on what else the Whitecaps do in the offseason. But I think, that would be a big change to move on from those two players. But I think if they're looking to make that step to be the best team in the West, it might be something they look at. I think they're looking at every possibility. So that's my bold offseason prediction. It's crazy because we're only a couple months away from the start of the season, and you know, some big things could come about.
Yeah, there's so many ways to go about this. I'm like, wow. I guess, yeah, I think my bold prediction is that the fourth DP ends up becoming a thing. And I think the Whitecaps go heavy on a DP center back. And I think to make it more specific, or actually go ahead.
Does that mean in this scenario, is that Richie as the third designated player, and then or like Richie's one of the four designated players in this scenario, or no?
No idea, because I think that there's an ideal scenario where you get Richie as a non-DP and you get two DPs. One of them's a striker. That leaves you room to get the center back. And I'm going to go DP center back. And to add, you know, more specifics, that's very vague. One who is older than 30, has significant top 5 league experience. Like, I think the Whitecaps go, screw it. Missed the chance to get a Chiellini type, missed the chance to get some other types. Go out and just get that sort of player and go, screw it. Yes, it's maybe Bucks convention, but they've done a good job enough of across the roster that, like Caleb has done a good job of mentioning, this is the time to go all in. So why not go all in with a 30-year-old plus center back? Might it be a good move long term? Who knows? But maybe like a bit more of a gamble like that after making the likes of Kubas, Gall, DP signings a bit more shrewd, where they kind of go, screw it, like, let's bring in a DP center back and really show that this year they want to go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that absolutely feeds into my comments about Ranko, right? Like, it's not that Ranko is a bad MLS player. It's just, it's time to make a bit of a chips into the middle of the table, screw it type play, where they really try to take a major step forward. And I think, you know, again, okay, conventional wisdom, maybe in the three designated player system, is that, oh, you shouldn't really spend that kind of capital on center back. But the Whitecaps are getting designated player level striking out of Brian White. You can afford to take a bit of a risk, I think, at this point in your development. You know, when you're a team that just finished second to last in the table, do you want to be spending designated player money on a over 30 center back? Probably not. But I think within their evolution as a side, it might be time to take a look. So I'm buying that bold prediction. I think that would be very interesting and potentially a really good move if they're able to get it right. Obviously, again, it's like, you know, that's a high risk acquisition. So it's not just about making that type of move. It's about making that type of move in the right way, which is, you know, a big question mark, obviously.
100%. And then for fun, just some names that to add to my prediction, like a Francesco Acerbi, Leo Bonucci. I'm just picking Italians because, you know, Vanny, I think he'd love a veteran Italian that he can just scream at in Italian and, you know, get that defensive spine. But that kind of player, like you know, someone, again, heavy top five league experience. I'm just adding the Italian link because it kind of makes sense to have that familiarity. I mean, Bonucci's, you know, at Union Berlin, so he's made a move outside of Italy. Maybe he could be pursued to head over to MLS, or a guy like Acerbi over at Inter. He's 35, so he's a bit older. But hey, again, that's the kind of win-now move where you can still do a job at that age at the center-back position, especially if put in the right position to succeed. So yeah, I'm going to go something even more specific, someone along those lines. I don't think exactly if it is. If it is, then well, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. But that sort of level of player.
Well, Alex, it will be very interesting to see which, if any, of our bold predictions, our way too early bold predictions for 2024, come true. Certainly the off-season ones, we're going to get an answer soon-ish. And, you know, we're going to stay attuned. Obviously, there's some contract option, roster deadline type stuff that's going to happen between now and the new year. So we'll keep our ears to the ground, being sensitive to all that stuff. And then obviously transfer window sort of opens in earnest at the start of 2024. So that should be exciting as well. Alex, we always find something to talk about, even when it's the depth of the off season and we start with an empty sheet of notes. I think this has been a ton of fun. I'm excited for what's to come. I feel reasonably confident and reasonably validated in our predictions at the start of the season. Feels like, you know, we're doing something right at the very least. So, you know, stay tuned for that at the start of 2024. We'll see if we can run it back in terms of our accuracy. And yeah, any final thoughts here before we sign off?
No, so always fun to do, and excited to see what December brings. It feels like November is a bit of a slow month for the Whitecaps. Of course, there was playoff, so it wasn't all that slow. Although I guess there was just one playoff game in November, technically. Otherwise, it's been quite quiet. But December, it feels like there'll be some good movement. So interested to see what happens. And, you know, who knows? Maybe there'll be some New Year surprises by January 1st. Because preseason starts like January 7th or 15th or whatever it is. So the Whitecaps business, it's going to come over the next 6 weeks. So exciting time ahead. And yeah, just keep an eye on all that. And of course, you know, Vancouver FC and Pacific as well, making some minor roster moves. So there's going to be some movement picking up there as well. League One BC, I'm sure there's going to be a bit more movement there, seeing what the 2024 season looks like. So yeah, lots to come. We'll keep an eye on it, of course, here at the Third Sub. On that note, you can find me on Twitter at Alex Gungurizic, on Threads and Instagram at AGR on the Case. And I'll throw it over to Sam, but thanks for all the listening, and excited to be back for this week.
Yeah, you can find me as always at Samuel_Rowboat on Twitter, at thirdsub.ca. I already gave Caleb a shout out, but you know, check out Coffee with the Caps, all the stuff on our site over the course of the off season and leading into next season as well, where we're gonna, you know, hopefully continue to provide really good coverage of all the Canadian soccer happenings out on the West Coast. So thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll chat again soon.